supervise, and then you go to chapel at 8 o'clock, or perhaps 8:05, a 10-minute chapel, which was done by faculty. The headmaster read a prayer, and then the faculty member read from the Bible a selection, which had been set up for him. He didn't choose his selection. And that was followed by going to class at 8:30. From 8:30 to 1 o'clock, classes. There was no break in the middle. It was straight through. There was no milk and crackers for the students. Everybody went until 1 o'clock. As a matter of fact, until 1:10 before lunch was served. It's a long time, they used to say, between breakfast and lunch. After lunch, there was a period of an hour before the athletics could begin. And people did various things, studied or socialized or whatever. Athletics then went from approximately 2:15 or thereabouts to 4:30. And then you finished up so that you could get the boys back to study hall, which came at 5:30. Study hall lasted an hour before supper at 6:30. Supper after supper, there was another study hall which was supervised by the faculty in rotation. You got it maybe once or twice a month or something of that nature. And you supervised study hall for 2 hours with a break in the middle. That lasted from roughly, let's say, 7:30 to 9:30. Then the students had a half an hour off, and the younger ones were in bed earlier than the older group. Seniors didn't have to go to study hall, mostly for younger students, the lower mids, preps, lower mids, and upper mids. Not too many upper mids, but those who needed it went to study hall. We had a very fascinating pair of twins, Dick and Guy Hughes, who came from St. Louis. When one of them was in study hall, we were never sure which one it was. They took turns. They had to laugh on us because it was hard, very difficult to tell them apart. And they were very nice kids. One of them, Dick, is now teaching at Hotchkiss. And Guy, I think, teaches at Milton Academy. Now there's the day. Many masters lived in the dormitory and had dormitory supervision starting right after supper and running through until bedtime. That would mean, depending on their age, anywhere from 10 to 11.
And what determined whether a master had dormitory service?
In those days, it's where you lived. And when you were hired, you were told if you lived in the dormitory, you would have dormitory supervision. Yeah. Presumably, you had one night off a week or whatever. I think it was left up to you to arrange to have a substitute there if you weren't there. Therefore, you could have more than one night off a week if you could get a substitute. And it wasn't hard. It seemed to me it worked out very well. There were no particular problems. You expected to do dormitory duty, and you did. Today, they don't like dormitory duty. Faculty, when they're brought on, rebel a little bit at this, and it has presented a problem to get people to live in the dormitory.
Now, what if you were married?
They have a set of dormitories. Most of them, I would say, had accommodations for married people. When we moved in, we had an apartment in Coy Hall, which had a kitchen, dining room, living room, two bedrooms, and a study. The study opened up on the dormitory corridor. Otherwise, you were private. And it was a very pleasant place to live.
Do you recall, if I remember correctly, you got there in 38, right?
Correct.
Yeah. What kind of salary did you get at that time?
Salary was $3,500.
And how did that compare, let's say, with public schools or schools across the country, or
As far as I know, it was probably comparable to the private schools, and the public schools generally in those days were lower.
That's right.
That was the
Now they were in the
impression
2000s.
I got. Yes, that was the impression I got.
Yeah.
And of course, remember, 3,500 included the dormitory, living in the dormitory, and food, for my wife and me. So it was more than 3,500. It was really a very good. We often look back and think Hamburg cost maybe 16 cents a pound, something like that in those days. So we were able to do all right.
What if children came along?
There's room. You see, you had the two bedrooms.
Uh-huh.
We had two children. One of the first, Stephen, was born while we were living in the dormitory. Nancy came along after we'd moved. We moved to a house. Mr. Ben Sanford had specified that the house, which was built for Mr. Monahan as the physical director, would go to his successor. Tony and I were unable to furnish it. We couldn't possibly live in a house. So we went into the dormitory for 2 years and then moved into the house and lived there from 1940 to 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the brick house up in the corner at the junction of 112 and 41.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Right there by Taylor Field. Yeah. Very nice house. Very pleasant.
Can you recall which experiences, it's a kind of a general question, that were, you know, satisfactory, outstanding experiences for you, or negative, or both? Does anything occur to you that stands out in your mind as experience?
Over what period?
Over your whole period of teaching. Any anecdotes, satisfactions?
Well, there was considerable satisfaction, it seemed to me, in watching the boys grow. I got great satisfaction out of coaching, which I did at the beginning and found it a very stimulating. I loved it, as a matter of fact. And we had a great rivalry with the Hill School, and it died because of the war and the travel. We couldn't keep it up. But we played them 3 years before the war, and we had two ties and one defeat in football. But it was quite exciting and rewarding. And the coaching to me was, at that point, as rewarding as anything. The teaching grew later on. Then I think there was a real feeling of accomplishment with the admissions work. Because I went into admissions work in the mid-50s. And that was very satisfying, because you were dealing with people, which I like to do, and I enjoyed talking to the candidates, interviewing them. So now, as to other things, I don't know what I can think of as negative or disappointing. I suppose there were some, but nothing stands out in my mind. It was all very pleasant and great. I enjoyed it, and I think my family did.
Good.
So that's about the best way to cover it. I'm sorry I can't give you
a
whole raft of
I think it's incidents. Wonderful that that's the way you remember it.
Yeah.
Just one other question relating to that a little bit. What changes have taken place at Hotchkiss that you can
point to? Hotchkiss has changed considerably. From Mr. Ben Sanford. Mr. Ben Sanford ran a very tight ship and a very intellectual faculty. He was an intellectual himself, and he expected you to do things as he did. If some teacher happened to be sick, he would step into the class and teach it. Probably everything except Russian, or maybe some strange language, but he could do math, science, English, history, anything, and that's the kind of person he was. So he'd expect you to be, you know, up on all the things possible. When he left, Mr. Chappell came. Mr. Chappell was an entirely different person who didn't take the job as seriously as he should have. And being casual, he lost touch with it, and eventually the board removed him. It took them 5 years to do it, and they should have done it sooner. For example, I was in admissions work then, and Mr. Chappell, mail would come to him that should have been turned over to me in requesting material on admissions. I wouldn't get it sometimes for a month. Just wasn't done. I had to go to his secretary, but she couldn't do much about it. Now that, I think, is telling tales out of school, but that's where the school just dropped. And it was true. Following Mr. Chappell, Mr. Olson took over. Now, Olson was a administrator, hard worker, and he went right to work and tightened things up. And I think he was there for about 20 years, long stay, and did a good job. He was succeeded by a man named Callard. Callard, who for 2 years, Mr. Callard arrived and announced that he would not be in his office on Saturdays. This is, of course, an inheritance from the day school. He'd been in a day school, and he thought Saturday was an off day. Saturday for a boarding school is busy as can be, busier than the other days in the sense that there are all kinds of activities, teams going away, teams coming, parents coming, and the whole just busy. So the fact that he wasn't going to be there kind of upset things. I think he had to be there, and he learned that a little bit. But he never did really fit into the picture of what a school life is like. School life takes up every bit of your time, every minute, night and day. And the headmaster gets telephone calls late at night. He gets all the parents who have to know something about their child. He has those problems, plus all the problems of just operating a school, kids, faculty, so on. So Callard didn't really fit into that, and he was succeeded by an interim, who was Mr. Arthur White, who then was elected as headmaster and was there, I guess, about 5 years. And Arthur was just really what they needed. Arthur broke down the staid qualities of Hotchkiss to a great degree. Arthur was just Arthur. He'd come from Maine, and he wouldn't change, in a sense, to become a formal headmaster. He was his own headmaster, which was great. And I think he improved the relations with the town, no question about it. And he endeared the faculty because he was interested in people, and he did things for people, and was warm, very warm person. So he changed things quite a bit. Now we have Mr. O'Dean, who's just been there a year, and I think he's a perfect person to do the job. Very intellectual, hard worker, intelligent, friendly, humorous, all the things you'd like. And I think he will do a very good job. He says he wants to stay there, and I think he probably will. I'm glad they got him. And they made an effort to get a person who was an intellectual, and this is not to denigrate Arthur White. Arthur would tell you he's not an intellectual in the sense that O'Dean is, or that Van Sanford was. Arthur is perfectly good teacher and student and so forth and so on, but he just wasn't the type. Now, O'Dean is the kind of person who can name you the kind of bugs that are crawling across the water while he's fly fishing. Van Sanford could do that too. Van Sanford visited me once in New Hampshire, and we went on a walk, and he gave me a lesson in ferns, some of which I've never forgotten. We went along, and he named the ferns and would tell you all about it. I thought, my God, yeah, it was marvelous. He was very good. The rumor is that the faculty, once upon a time, way back, decided they'd try to stump him, and they picked out something, very difficult and subject like, I don't know, flowers or something. Anyway, whatever the subject was, when they asked him about it, according to the story, he said to them, well, I'm a little rusty since I wrote the article for the Encyclopedia Britannica, but I'll try to do what I can with it. But that's of course probably an apocryphal story, but it's a good one.
How much input did the faculty have in, let us say, policy decision making?
Oh, I forgot to tell you about the faculty life in a day. Faculty meetings occurred Monday night. The faculty had...
They were weekly meetings?
Weekly meetings. And the faculty had a committee known as the Dormitory Committee, which included the people who lived in the dormitory, because there were others who lived outside and not in the dormitories. We had some houses around as they do now. And the Dormitory Committee handled discipline. And discipline was handled by reports that came in from faculty members to the discipline committee to be handled. Some boy had thrown a record down the stairwell and so on, or a snowball through the window, and all that sort of thing. And following the dormitory committee, which lasted anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour, the faculty would convene. These were held over in the headmaster's house down in the, it's changed a little bit now, but it was down in the room which is off the dining room. Below was a big study, you might say, or a library, with a large plate glass window that looked right out towards the lake. The faculty meeting would go on, and Mr. Van Sanford ran the faculty meeting, but there's no question but what the faculty had a great deal of input. People were called upon, and he was willing and listened to what came. When he got stuck, when things didn't go exactly the way he wanted, the faculty meeting went on and on and on until things worked around and it seemed to come to his point of view. And then the fact is that we stayed sometimes till midnight. Yes. And then of course on faculty meetings we had every marking period, and there were two or three marking periods a semester. We were on semesters at that time, two a year. And I think three marking periods. At the end of each marking period, you had a meeting of all the teachers of that class. And then they went over every boy. And it was covered completely. And then the report went home, whatever it was. So you had to report, because you were an advisor, each teacher, each faculty member was an advisor for a certain number of boys. And that was his job, to make sure that he got all those reports together and got them to the head. And at the meeting, it was turned over. The advisor reported and said, I've got this report from Mr. So-and-so, and this boy is not doing his homework or whatever. And it was a very thorough analysis of each youngster. And I was amazed, because I'd been in the prep school where they didn't do that. And this was good.
That's good. I note, of course, now that there are Asian students, black students.
Oh, yes.
When did that...
We got the first black student in 1952. He came from Washington, D.C., and his father, I think, worked in the postal system. His name escapes me, George something other, but... He was a good boy, and he was very thoroughly researched before, so we'd have no problem. From then on, we began to get more slowly. It grew, and I don't know how many they have now, but they obviously are making an effort to be international.
Yes.
We didn't try. We didn't make that much of an effort in those days.
Did that bring any negative problems,
here?
Or did it result in positive relationships?
I don't think there are any negative problems at all. Positive relationships, it's hard to say. I know I found that later on when I went down to Mercersburg and had to integrate the academy, that the blacks, after a bit, tended to stay together. We had maybe 15 out of 500 and some students. And they tended to stay together. We would try to room them all over the place and room them with white students as well, work this up. But they tended to come together. I don't know whether that's happened at Hotchkiss or not. They have some black boys and girls who were very nice kids. And I've talked to them and met them, watched them in their athletics. And I think they're fine. So I suppose there's some very good positive answers there. What happened, the fellow's name was Gus something or other, the first one. And I think he's a doctor now. But I'm sure that some of them really came out of it with a tremendous education and a opportunity, potential for the future.
Was faculty integrated at any point? I know there's an Indian in the stage department, and also I met one of the admission people who was a black one.
Yeah. Now the faculty is integrated. It was not...
Not in that day.
Not back there. I'm trying to think of whether... I don't think we had any black faculty. I had to do that at Mercersburg. I got a black man. The faculty wanted it. They told me, so forth. But I don't think we did. It would have come along naturally as time went by, I'm sure. And I suppose Olson did it. I don't know.
Let's pick up on what you have there, Bill.
Well. You wanted to know what else do you want to know about the school?
Well, the other area that we can talk about that now or later, however you want to, is the relations with the community, which you did express in terms of sports very clearly and wonderful relations. But you were going to, at one point,
tell you about the people in town.
The people in town and what the town was like when you first came.
Yeah. All right. The town was a good example of a small New England town, but one that was very, and still is, civic-minded. This town had good people in it who wanted to do things for others, and I think it's an unusual town in that way. Once upon a time, the railroad came through here. I don't know just when it went out, but it was the railroad that went from Hartford to Millerton. And it joined up with the Harlem Valley in Millerton, and so you could either go north or south there, north up to Pittsfield or south to New York, New Haven. And then there was also in Canaan a crossroad because the New Haven Railroad came from Pittsfield down in the Housatonic and through Danbury and on New Haven into New York. The Harlem Valley, of course, came a little west and down into New York. It seemed a bit unusual to have two paralleling each other so close, but there they were. The train that came through Lakeville came from Hartford, and I think it was called the Connecticut Central or something. That was gone when we arrived, and I don't know how long it had been gone, but the old station was there, still is. It's now the Public Health Nursing. But there was a viaduct over the road, over Route 41, big metal viaduct across there, and the embankment is on the other side, is still there, you can see it, it goes behind the community service buildings back there, community service store yards, and that went right across through Salisbury and then swung over into Canaan and up across Twin Lakes.
Let's stop at that viaduct a minute. You say that viaduct was on 41?
Yes.
In other words, not in Lakeville.
Right in Lakeville.
Oh, in Lakeville.
41 comes into 44.
Where it turns off. Yeah, it turns off from 44.
You know where the station is?
Yeah.
Well, the station is this way. It went across.
Oh, where the fire station and the...
Well, yes, sort of. Uh-huh. It's a little bit... I'd say south of the fire station, just a yard or two or three, and it went right across there, and you know where the baseball field
right.
is? Well, the baseball field has a big embankment out there. That's the railroad right of way, an embankment. It went right across there. It was still there, I remember, but it was, I don't know just when it was taken down. Obviously, they got it down and made the town more beautiful, but the railroad played a big part in it. People tell me that they used to take and go to Millerton, just ride over to Millerton instead of a bus or whatever, to get on the train, go over to London, get, pick it up coming back. Now, the town was quite different in a sense than you find it today, because 41 and 44 came together where they do now, but there was no no way of handling the traffic. The road came directly down from Millerton, down the hill, Millerton Road, and 41 came into it, and just on that, where that juncture was, on the far side, beyond the east side of the road, stood Dufour's garage, run by Lee Dufour, his brother Les, and the other brother Ray. And this was sort of the center of many things in the town. You could get almost anything at Dufour's, and it was done very, with a very friendly attitude and rather casual. I remember, well, I bought some tires there for my car, and the bill came twice. And I said something to Lee, I said, you know, I paid this. Oh, he said that Ma, Mrs. Dufour, his mother, was running the books. And he said, Ma made a mistake, just cross it off, don't let it bother you.
Your words,
boy. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. And like in the old West, where a handshake was enough.
That's all you needed, and just your word, and that was it. And the town, that garage was really a center in many ways, because they would get you taxi rides and whatnot. Although there were other taxis, there were other drivers in town. This was the important one. Now, just below Dufour's, and that would mean going south on 41, now it is gas station and that area. There were stores. There was a store run by Mr. Barnett, who was the local Charlotte Reed,
the select person.
Select man in those days. He was select man probably even longer than Charlotte.
Oh, yes.
He had a long and very happy administration. He was liked by both parties. There was no trouble, and Bill was just a good man to run it, and he did. Well, there was a store there. I think Barnett's store was sort of a general store, you know the type?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And next to it was a liquor store, and then I think there was a gas station a little further down, pretty much where Farnham Road goes off and 41 starts up the hill. The people in town were a fascinating group, and of course, probably as good and normal a spread of people as you'd find. For instance, Bill Rainsford was one of the local builders, and his irons were so big he had to cut the sleeves in his shirt in order to get it on. And Bill was a character. There was a man who might be called retarded, or a half-wit, as they used to call him. His name was Hen Day, and Hen, I think, drank, probably. At any rate, now and again, a paper, a little article would come in the Lakeville Journal about something that Hen Day had seen. And these were fascinating, rather humorous little things. A man named Leverty, they called him Dr. Leverty, the boys did, he ran a drugstore up now just beyond the insurance building, mm-hmm. which was a bank, and it was the bank in those days. And across the street was the Leverty's drugstore, and of course the students all went in there, and he kept magazines around, and they were covered with chocolate and ice cream and everything the boys spilled on it. And he enjoyed them, and they, although he was kind of a gruff old fellow, he chewed tobacco, I remember, and he was, on the other hand, ran a pretty good drugstore, although it began to slow down as he got older. Let's see, I've got a list here. I might get some others. Of the people around town. The Whelans family, there were four brothers, Brick, Turk, Brick, Buck, and Babe. And they were very athletic. They played on the town teams, and they were a very lively bunch. The family was one that had been here for some time. The doctor in town, at least one of them, was old Doc Peterson. He was just known as Doc Pete. And everybody went to Doc Pete, and he took care of everything. You're a family doctor of the old tradition. Everything, didn't matter what.
And yeah, what was his last name?
Peterson.
Peterson.
And they called him Doc Pete. And he was a very friendly, nice fellow. There was a dentist, Dr. Barr, B-A-R-R. Doc Barr was on the basketball team, I remember. Doc and I played together. He was a very pleasant fellow. And he was the dentist, had his office above the bank. A very interesting character in town, Hop Rudd. I think I mentioned him before. But Hop was just Hop, nothing else. No pretense, no guile, and lovely. I mentioned he wrote a line in the paper called Memory Lane.
Yes.
He was a very popular and well-known character in town. He was also a baseball player, as I mentioned. Tom Wagner, who was the leading lawyer, although there were lots of lawyers, and always have been for some reason or other in Lakeville. Tom was a little different in many ways. I think he suffered from depressions. I know he did, as a matter of fact. And yet he was a man who did a great deal of good, most of it without anybody knowing it. He helped people all through the town. He did lots of good things in that way when people were in trouble, and giving them legal advice and whatnot for nothing. He was just that kind of a person, but he would never admit it. I mean, he had a quirk in that sense. Tom was a very good friend of mine, and Tom had a party every year on a place. He lived over where 41 joins under the Indian Mountain Road. He lived there at that junction on the lakeside, and he owned down to the lake, and then down there he had a cabin and a big fireplace. And he used to give a party there when the fishing season opened. And his party started Friday night and went on until Sunday afternoon.
Wow.
And I mean that, it went on, it never stopped. I think they would go to sleep. I went to it, but I lived up in Hotchkiss, so I didn't stay overnight. You could stay down in that cabin of his. But it was fascinating and great fun. It had a diverse group who came, all of them fishermen mainly, and there was a good deal of drinking, a good deal of boisterous fun, and it just went on and on. Fran, Tom's wife, never came down. She stayed up at the house. She was smart enough not to come down there. None of the wives came, and I wondered, as others did, how some of them got home. But they managed to. There was never an accident that I know of. And they, everyone had a good time, and it brought everybody together. So Tom was sorely missed on that one when he died, and that stopped. The barbers in town were Paul Argle and Chet Thurston. Paul Argle cut the students' hair at Hotchkiss, and he had a little room in the basement of one of the dorms. No overhead, no problem, and he'd do about five an hour, or six an hour, and had the ideal situation. The boys signed up and went in, he clipped them off, and I'd say for a barber, you couldn't beat it. Heat, everything was there. No overhead at all. Chet Thurston was quite different. Chet was a big, heavy man. And he had his barber shop up on the Route 41 towards beyond Leverty's. I would say that George Milmine, George Van Sanford, and M. Quayle, two of them, the headmasters of Hotchkiss and Salisbury. George Milmine was the assistant head at Hotchkiss at that time. George helped the town in the financial area. George Van Sanford also, and George Milmine was a definite Republican. George Van Sanford was a Democrat and helped the Democratic Party and was active in it here. I don't know what M. Quayle was, but my guess is he was a Republican. He was a Yale graduate and a very pleasant fellow. and an able headmaster, and tragically died about the time of the war from an embolism resulting from an operation on his elbow. He was a tennis player, and he had tennis elbow, and he wanted to get it fixed, and died of this block.
Now, Mr. Quayle was of from Salisbury School.
Salisbury School. There was an interesting character named Kent Fulton, who lived here, very wealthy. He built a golf course out of the mountainside in Salisbury, north of Salisbury, about a mile, on Route 41. It was called Hobnob Hill. 18 holes, beautiful golf course, just carved out of the mountainside and the woods and the valleys. And you played on it by invitation. He would say, will you join in? Coming down to Hotchkiss as the athletic man, he invited us to play. We didn't play very much because we weren't golfers, but we did go over. You had to play at least once or you wouldn't be invited back. And this was a fascinating course and well known, quite well known. It died because of his death at the end of the war, and then just was sold off. And now you can see the traces of it if you look on the left-hand side of the road, about a mile north, and you can see there's a house that was the caddy house and the golf house, and then his house was further up, and the golf course went around it and up into the mountainside. Most unusual thing. There are lots of, there are other people, some of them I suspect are probably not, you know, they're young and younger and so forth. Mrs. Hall in Newkirk.
We didn't get that on tape though.
Didn't you?
No.
Well, Mrs. Hall, her husband taught at Hotchkiss, known as Peanuts Hall. He taught American history. Charlotte Reed's father. And he died before we got here. Mrs. Hall was then living in the house on Elm Street, the big house. She was quite ill one winter with pneumonia or something. At any rate, Mr. Newkirk, who ran the local funeral parlor, thought that this would be a very lucrative funeral if she died, and he decided not to go to Florida that winter because it looked as though she might die, and these were the prognostications. So he stayed home, and she recovered nicely, and being a good humored person, enjoyed the whole thing very much because she felt that she'd fooled Mr. Newkirk by living on, and I don't know how much longer she lived afterwards, but she did for quite a while.
That much worse. I'm not sure how.
There was a shoe man down where there's a little boutique shop there on 40, where just where 41 and 44 come together. His name was Danny Lafredo.
Oh, yes.
Everybody knew Danny. I'm sure you've heard of him.
Oh, I met him.
Did you meet him?
Yes.
Oh, of course you would. Well, Danny was a good friend of mine, and I often went into his shop when I had an office in Lakeland. I'd stop in and say, buongiorno, and we'd go through a little Italiano. I didn't know anything, but just a word or two. But it was really, he was the nicest, friendliest fellow, and he did a little of everything. He was a little fellow, and he had his machine back at the counter, and he would step on something and the wheels would begin to turn, and he'd have it all set up. And he was just a lovely person. Really, everybody liked Danny. You couldn't help it.
And he was a skilled craftsman.
Yes, he was. He was definitely a skilled craftsman. Across the street was a place called the Jigger Shop. And that was just below the viaduct on the street that goes up past the market now and the pizza place, the brother's place.
Oh, yes.
To eat that street. There was a shop right on the corner. It's a laundromat. That was called the Jigger Shop. The students went in, the Hotchkiss students went in there too. That was another place to eat and enjoy yourself and so forth. As I mentioned a little earlier, the way the configuration of the roads, they met in a V there. Now, of course, you have an entirely different sort of situation. I mean, this coming down from Millerton, you went right, if you just kept going, you'd go right into Dewforce if you didn't make the turn. Now, of course, they have it so that it's cut this way, and this road cuts down into it, if you know what I mean. I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
I've got a pen here.
It goes by that community store and...
Yeah.
Whatever they call that.
Yes. Now you've got this road comes down and there's a cut here, and you come here and this road comes and you can go this way,
right,
or you can come this way, and there's a blinker light. Very complicated, and we always thought that the person who laid that out thought it was flat. That it would be fine for a flat place instead of a hill.
Say that there was a blinker light there?
No, there was nothing. There is now.
Well, there is a blinker
light. Oh, yes.
<Not those.
laughs> Yeah, there's a blinker light, and it's new, I think, but it's your blinker light, and it's red one way, so it stops you. For instance, if you're coming down here, it blinks you right there. There's a stop sign, too, but I think there's a blinker there now. Anyhow, it's stop street. But it changed the whole thing, and everybody fussed about it. Now everyone's used to it, and there's no problem. But that was the argument. It should have been on a flat surface instead of a hillside, because it makes it difficult to turn here and go up this hill. Rather difficult. And I know there is a blinker there keeping you from going across. The right of way is one way. That's the post office was about where it was on Porter Street, and there was a creek up here that came across.
Yeah.
I've forgotten the name of that.
Yeah.
Warner lived up there. And the bank was on this corner in those days, Leverty's. And this is the factory pond. There was an inn up here called the Gateway Inn. It's gone long since. But we went there to a banquet when we were first here for, I think it was for the pitcher on the baseball team, Brick Whalen, who won 14 games and lost one or something. At any rate, one of the old-timers in town told me that when he was a kid, they used to go up to the Gateway, and then all this dirt road, and they'd get their skis, and they'd come down there and ski down from the Gateway, down all the way across here to the factory pond, and have a whale of a time. I guess they probably maybe even used toboggans. But it was a good hill, and this was a place to gather, and I understand from what he told me, and he was I don't know if he was an alcoholic, but I know he drank a good deal. His name was Danny Ashman, and he was his own worst enemy. But he was one who told me about what fun they had up there. So some of it may have been a spree. Mm-hmm. Some of it may have been legitimate. But that was one thing I remember about it. Of course, he also used to take ice out of the lake.
Oh, yes.
Hotchkiss had an ice house. And the man who was in charge of the grounds at Hotchkiss was named John Cardoza. John Cardoza was about as rugged an individual as I've ever known. It's said that he climbed to the top of the Hotchkiss flagpole in order to put the rope up through the pulley. No one else would go up there, I'm sure, and he must have been in his 50s when he did it. Incredible man. He had one finger with a short one section here because he'd done the ice. And two chunks of ice down there had come together when he was getting them out of the lake. And John ran his crew with an iron hand. George Van Sanford, the headmaster, trusted John completely. They were two very strong characters and personalities. I don't know whether they'd have gotten along if he hadn't done this. And John himself admired, respected the Duke. and so they worked it
the
out.
The Duke, you
He's
said?
Vin Sanford.
He was called the Duke? Duke?
Yes, oh yes, called the Duke. He was, I think the best way to, is a story about the Duke of Wellington and the Battle of Waterloo.
Oh, his troops.
Yes.
I'll tell that
one. Well, did I tell that one?
No, go ahead.
Here it is. I read this somewhere, and I was reading about Wellington and Waterloo. Apparently, Wellington came riding up at a crucial time when the French were really pounding his line, and someone on the British line said, "Stand front, here comes the Duke." So I have used that and I did it once when he was with me, and I'm so glad, George Van Sanford. I said, that is exactly the way George Van Sanford was. You stood front when George Van Sanford was with you. He made you, some or other, be your best. His presence did that. So I say, you stand front here.